Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Weeks of protests over the death of George Floyd, combined with the well-known series of lethal incidents between African Americans and police across the nation, have brought us to an inflection point. After decades of forbearance, African Americans are no longer satisfied with platitudes and promises. They want action. This time, a majority of Americans, white Americans, appears to be on their side, and many are turning to history books to better understand how we got to this moment, uncovering events we never learned in school. We've explored this history many times over the years, and today we start a week-long series revisiting some of those previous programs. We'll look at the ugly history of lynchings in the South and what we might learn from them today. We examine how the law and policy decisions resulted in ongoing segregation, and we learn how the unequal application of justice resulted in the mass incarceration of far too many African Americans. But we begin with the Great Migration. From 1915 to the 1970s, millions of African Americans moved from the South to cities in the North and West in search of a better life and greater opportunity. Isabel Wilkerson tells that story in her book, The Warmth of Other Suns, the epic story of America's Great Migration. She joined us in 2011, and I asked her, given the millions of people who took part in this migration and its impact on cities, why it was so underreported.
Well, I believe it's been underreported for many reasons, but one of the main reasons is because the people didn't talk about it. The people who were part of this Great Migration, there were 6 million of them who left all parts of the South for all parts of the North and West from the time of World War I until the 1970s. Many of them were in some ways defecting a caste system which was prevalent and which ruled in some ways the lives of all people who were living in the South, black or white, and they were in some ways defecting that caste system for the freedom that they perceived as being possible in other parts of the country at that time. And many of them had experienced a world which is hard for us to recall or remember or even imagine now because we're so far removed from it. But they were leaving a world in which it was actually against the law for a black person and a white person to merely play checkers together in Birmingham. They were leaving a world in which there was actually a black Bible and a white Bible to swear to tell the truth on in many courtrooms throughout the South. And they were leaving a world in which it was actually against the law for a black person to pass a white person. If they were driving on the road, it was against the law for them to, as black motorists, pass a white motorist on the road, no matter how slowly that person was going. And, of course, it was an era of great violence to enforce the caste system as it had been created. And so they were in some ways seeking political asylum within the borders of their own country, and they simply didn't tell their own children and grandchildren about it. They kept it to themselves. It was almost as if they were experiencing a kind of post-traumatic stress, and they didn't talk about it.
Yeah, it was, as I read those comments, it seemed to me that it's not unlike a lot of war veterans who come back from wars and they don't talk to their children, they don't talk to their spouses about what they did, what they witnessed in a war. They just don't talk about it ever, and they only talk about it among those who experienced it as they did. Did you find that to be the case when you talked to all these people?
I found that many of the experiences that the people told me, they had not told their own children, and therefore the children, upon first reading, beginning to read the book, had not known these things themselves about their own parents or grandparents. And I myself am a child of this migration, and my own parents didn't talk about it. I did not grow up with the idea of there being participants in this great movement. No one ever referred to it as the Great Migration when I was growing up. I knew very little about what my parents' background had been except for the cities, the towns that they had been from in Georgia and in Virginia, and they simply didn't talk about it. It's almost like an immigrant experience in which once they leave, they don't look back, and it's almost as if life begins for them upon arrival in the new world.
Hmm. Why then did they open up to you? If they won't talk to their own children about it, why did they talk to you about it?
Well, I set out to try to, in some ways, restore this part of American history to its rightful place because of the massive impact that it had on all parts of the country, particularly the northern cities and the western cities and the south itself. And I went about interviewing over 1,200 people in order to narrow it down to the three that would ultimately be the protagonists through whom the stories would be told. And so I talked to many, many people, all of them at different stages of willingness to talk. You know, some of them were willing to talk about one aspect of it, but not another. Some of them were mired in discussions about experiences upon arrival, but not so much what happened before. So I heard a range of stories in interviewing 1,200, and ultimately I narrowed it down to about 30. Any one of them could have been among the three, but these are people who had reached a point in their own personal journey. They were of an age or at the stage of their lives where they were willing to be retrospective and to try to, in some ways, seek this kind of catharsis, this kind of searching for meaning in their own lives. Many of them were octogenarians who had lived out their lives and were willing to look back with reflection, and they were the ones that I spoke to.
What makes your book really, I mean, it's a wonderful book, but what makes it really interesting to many is the fact that you're telling this epic story, but you've distilled it down and mixed in the stories of three unique individuals who were part of this great migration. And that's after you spoke to 1,200 of the millions of people who made this migration. How did you choose the 1,200 to talk to? And then how did you decide on the final three who would make the cut for the book?
I interviewed the 1,200 as part of a searching for understanding of what they had experienced overall. The structure of the book is that there are three main routes that the people took when they exited the South. There was the East Coast route, which carried people from Georgia, Florida, the Carolinas, and Virginia to Washington, D.C., to Philadelphia, New York, and further north. And then there was the Midwest migration, which carried people from Alabama, Mississippi, Tennessee, and Arkansas to Chicago, Detroit, Cleveland, and the entire Midwest. And then there was the West Coast stream, which took people from Texas and Louisiana to California and the entire West Coast. So the search was for one person to represent each of those three migration streams. So I interviewed people in what are called the receiving stations, the big cities of the North and the West that the people went to, that represent the end point of each of those journeys, those different streams. So I interviewed people in New York and in Chicago and Los Angeles with an eye toward identifying one person out of all the hundreds of people I might interview in any one city, one person to represent that journey to that particular part of the country. And so I narrowed it down from the 1,200 once I had identified the individuals who would represent together a sense of what it would have been like to be a part of this great migration. In other words, each of them left for different reasons from different parts of the South, ended up in different parts of the North, and all had their own specific experiences. And they were also characters, too. One of them is a physician who had been a surgeon in the Army, couldn't practice in Louisiana once he got out of the Korean conflict and decides to go off to California, but he finds that he has a difficult time getting to California, a very difficult time driving, and he's a character. He's a gambler. He becomes sort of a physician to some rich and famous people out in California. He's quite the character unto himself. So those are some of the things I was looking for as I was narrowing it down to the three.
How did you become aware that there were these three tracks, one from the southeast coast of the United States to the northeast coast, one from the mid-south in terms of east to west-south to the Midwest, and one from the western south to the far west? Why these three tracks? And were most people taking those tracks? In other words, if you lived in South Carolina, were you most likely always to go to Washington and points north as opposed to California or Chicago?
There are exceptions. One major exception is a grandfather of Michelle Obama, who had gone from South Carolina to Chicago. So he did. There, you know, human beings are delightfully independent at times, and so they're also delightfully predictable in other ways. But so there are some unique diversions from what are the general streams. But for the most part, Where it comes through is when you go to these receiving stations, these big cities of the North, and you talk to people who are African American, and you find if you're in Washington, D.C., if you're in Philadelphia, North Carolina and South Carolina were the primary contributors of many of the people who are now in Washington and in Philadelphia and New York. When you go there, you will find many, many, many people who are descended from those who were part of this great migration from those particular states. And that's the beautiful predictability of how people migrate. And I make a comparison between their decisions and those of people who crossed the Atlantic, crossed the Pacific Ocean, crossed the Rio Grande to get to the United States. And where you go to certain parts of Boston or certain parts of New York, the Lower East Side, and you'll find that there are many, many people of Italian descent. You'll find many, many people of Irish descent. You go to Minnesota, and there are many people who are Scandinavian in descent. And it's the same thing. When people leave, they generally follow a particular track, and that particular track is where other people like themselves are also going. And that's the beautiful predictability of what people do when they migrate.
And am I right in saying that you don't really consider these people as migrants so much as you consider them immigrants?
I consider them immigrants with an E, which is a little different. Emigrant, meaning that they were leaving one place in search of another place. But one of the things about this migration is that it was the first time and really the only time that American citizens had to leave the land of their birth for another part of their own country just to be recognized as the citizens to which they had actually been born. And that's what they felt they needed to do. And that's why I consider it to be similar to an immigrant experience. In some ways, these people are proxies for people in all of our backgrounds who had to have done what the people in this book did just for us to be here. I mean, that's how America got populated to the degree that it did, because people came from far away, set out on a journey to make a life for themselves and for their families that they felt they couldn't have had back home. And that's what these people did.
This book is valuable on many different levels, one of which, I suppose, is the fact that you were fortunate enough to be in a position to write about history and talk to the people who made that history. But you were in a race against the clock to talk to some of these people, because many of them, this began in 1915, many of them have already gone, and many of them are facing the exit point, I suppose. So what is this kind of first-person research? How does it impact the ability to tell a story?
I want to tell the story through the eyes of people who had actually made the decision to go, which made this an extremely time-pressured endeavor, because there are many people who would be part of any migration experience, and they're what I call lap children to any migration. And I ran into many, many people who were the lap children of this journey. They were the children in their mother's laps or in the back seat of the cars. And I wanted to get the people who actually were the decision makers to understand how such a migration could occur. What were the factors that led a person to make a decision to leave? Because, of course, many people did not leave. And I wanted to understand, how does one make that decision? How did this country get settled, you might say, and how did the North change so dramatically because so many African Americans left for the South, from the South to the North? And so that I was in this race against time, because the great number of them had passed away. Many of them were passing away even as I was doing the research. And I was running into many, many children who did not actually have the experience. Many of the children were senior citizens at the time I was going out to do the research. So it was truly a race against the clock to get them before it was too late.
Isabel, we have to take a break. So let me interrupt you there, and we'll finish that on the other side. And we'll also meet the three people that you focus in on in this book, The Warmth of Other Suns, The Epic Story of America's Great Migration, with our guest, Isabel Wilkerson, Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're in the middle of a conversation with Isabel Wilkerson, a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and writer and the author of The Warmth of Other Suns, The Epic Story of America's Great Migration. This is a migration of African Americans from the South to other parts of this country in the early part of the 20th century, from just after World War I to the mid-1970s. You spent 15 years gathering information for this book. You spoke to 1,200 people, and you narrowed the story down to telling the story through the eyes and experiences of three individuals, Ida Mae Gladney, George Starling, and Dr. Robert Foster. How did you find each of these people?
I went to senior centers. I went to AARP meetings on the south side of Chicago. I went to Baptist churches in New York where everybody was from South Carolina. I went to places in Washington, D.C. where everyone was from North Carolina. I went to Catholic churches in Los Angeles where everybody was from Louisiana. I went to the individual state clubs in these northern cities where people had created these colonies and were retaining the culture that they had grown up under and that they still so honored and cherished. In Chicago, for example, there are actually many, many Mississippi clubs. There's a Greenwood Mississippi Club, Greenville Mississippi Club, Newton Mississippi Club, Brookhaven Mississippi Club, and all these different clubs, the people meet, but they don't go to the ones that are not of their town. So that they actually retain much of the culture. And so there are many, many places where I could go to find individuals who had been part of this migration. I went to all those places in order to find these three individuals that narrowed it down to from the 1,200 original that I had.
And you said that you wanted these people to be from these three different, or to typify these three different routes of migration out of the South or emigration out of the South. And I suppose that played a major role in deciding this. But what made these three individual stories compelling enough for you to think, well, these are the people that need to be featured in this book?
These were people who were like anyone else, meaning these are people whose names you would not have otherwise known. They're not famous people. They are people like anyone else who were ordinary people under extraordinary circumstances who had to make the decision of their lives. And they are individuals that anyone can relate to. One of them is a woman, for example, who is a sharecropper's wife in Mississippi, and she has the misfortune of having been terrible at picking cotton, which is a true disadvantage if that's your job.
and yet, you went back to her home place with Ida Mae Gladney, and she wanted you and she to pick cotton together for a second. And you did.
She did. Yeah, it had been 60 years since she had left. She was now a woman in her 80s. She had left when she was in her 20s with her young family, and she wanted to. We were driving through the field, through the road that was passing many, many cotton fields to get back to the town or the county that she had been from in Mississippi. And it was at the time that she had left, which meant it was time that the cotton was coming, had come into bloom. And she saw it, and she wanted to jump out of the car and pick some. It was as if some ancient memory had been activated in her, and she wanted to get out and pick. Even though she had hated it when she was there, somehow it reminded her of something, and she wanted to get out. And I said to her, you know, are you sure we can do this? Because this cotton belongs to somebody. This is not ours to do. And besides, we're in Mississippi. I was reminding her of that. And she said, oh, they're not going to care what little bit we pick. And there was no one anywhere. I mean, it was really, truly out in the country. So she hopped out of the car, and she went in, and she showed me how you actually do that. I'd never done that before. My migration stream was very different from hers. And I still have, to this day, the cotton that we picked many years ago.
Wow.
When I did that.
So
her.
Ida Mae Gladney was somebody who was stuck in a job in a part of the country, in a part of the world, and in terms of who she was at the time, could only do one thing, and that was pick cotton, and she wasn't any good at it. So she decided she had to leave.
That wasn't really the reason
she
left, though. I mean, that was one of the, but that was interesting. One of the things that drew me to her was that she was so beautifully humanly flawed, meaning that she was a beautiful person, but she had, like any of us, our strengths and weaknesses,
right.
And this is one of her weaknesses, and she was willing to be open about that, and that was an important thing when you want readers or anyone to identify with an individual that they're reading about.
Right. George Starling, tell me about him.
George Starling was a young man who had had the chance to go to college, a couple years of college in Florida when the money ran out, and he had to return to the work of the people in his part of Florida, which was picking citrus. Because he'd had a little bit of education, he could see that the people were being cheated in their pay. But they had no recourse. If the grove owners said they were paying them this amount, there was nothing they could do. And he had had a little bit of exposure to another way of looking at the world, and he set about trying to press for better wages and work conditions for the people. But for having done that, he actually ran right up against the caste system that did not permit African Americans at that point to make such claims against system and to argue or advocate on their own behalf. And so he ended up having to leave with essentially a lynching in the works for him. He had to flee for his life, and he went to Harlem, to New York, in order to flee. And he did not return to his home state for many, many years as a result of that.
Hmm. And Dr. Robert Foster's story is typical of a lot of people in that era, African-Americans in that era, who distinguished themselves through education and through experience. He was a medical doctor, a surgeon. And then, and he practiced surgery in the war, as you said, in the Korean War. But when he came back home, was not permitted to do what he was trained to do.
That's right. He returned home after the Korean conflict, where he had been able to work as a physician in the hospital with all the accoutrements that go with that. But when he got back out of the war, he could not practice surgery in his own hometown of Monroe, Louisiana. And so he set out for a place called California. And that would have been the route for people in his part of the South to go. And he, in order to get there, he had to drive. He had a Buick Roadmaster, and he found that even once he got out of the bounds of what would have been considered Jim Crow territory, he still had a difficult time finding a place to take him in for the night.
Yes, he thought that once he got beyond Texas, which was, I guess, the far western southern state, that he would be all right. All of the Jim Crow era laws and regulations would drop away, and he found that not to be the case. What was his reaction to that? Did he tell you about what his first reaction to that was?
Oh, he talked extensively about it. In fact, he said, of course, he had not talked with his own children about it, but he was at the point where he was willing to share it or unburden himself, one might say. And he said to me, "This thing I've gone over 3,000 times trying to figure out what it is that happened to me and what could have been done. And there was nothing that could have been done because people wouldn't take it." And he had miscalculated the extent of what would have been considered Jim Crow segregation and how far it extended well beyond the borders of Texas. And he paid a price for it because he was not able to rest through three states of the West, and he was not a good driver, and the road was the terrain was rocky and forbidding and mountainous and desert, and he was driving at night, and he found that he felt such a sense of despair because he could not return. He could not turn around and go back. He was too far into the drive to turn back. There were many, many pressures on him from in-laws and from others who had warned him not to go to begin with. And it puts you in the heart and the mind of people who had to make this great decision. Really, in all of our backgrounds, the sense of regret and worry and anxiety as to whether they were making the right decision or not. And he went over this with me, and he described it. And I, in fact, tried to recreate that journey myself. I actually rented a Buick as he had. I had my parents in the car with me, and we retraced his exact journey in order to be able to make it come alive. So I saw every place that he went. I drove the car to the degree that he had. In other words, I didn't stop if he had not been able to stop, and I almost fell asleep at the wheel as well. And when I did that, my parents said, "You have to stop the car, and if you don't stop the car, let us out. This is really dangerous." And we ended up stopping in a place called Yuma, Arizona, where we had no trouble finding a place to stay for the night because it was no longer 1953, and the world has changed so very much since that time. But this is an effort to try to recreate something that had happened not that long ago. This is within the lifespan of many people who are alive today. 1953 seems like a world away, but it really was not that far away. And this world that he was in actually lasted until the 1970s. the difficulty of being able to, or the uncertainty of not knowing whether you'd be able to find a place, lasted well into the 1970s.
Which begs the question, why were people moving if it wasn't going to be any better? Did they just simply believe in their hearts that it was going to be better in Chicago, in Detroit, in Washington, in New York, in California, and then came to find out that it wasn't all that much better?
That's a great question. The thing is that they believed that it would be better. They hoped that it would be better. And they had never really, in these large numbers, had never really had the opportunity to really see or live it for themselves. It was marginally better in many respects. In one respect, for people who had been sharecroppers and who had never been paid for their labor, many of them were working merely for the right to live on the land that they were farming. Mm-hmm. They were not being paid. Just by going to these northern cities during that era of industrialization, they could be paid for work that they had never been paid for before. They found that life was so much more expensive in these places, and they were limited and cordoned off to certain parts of these cities that were reserved for people who looked like them, that they could not really move anywhere freely that they might have wanted to. So there were marginal improvements in certain aspects of their lives. They didn't have to live under the same Jim Crow caste system that had existed in the South in a more open way, meaning there were no colored-only signs, and they didn't have to step off the sidewalk when a white person approached. There were certain indignities that they did not have to experience upon arrival, but there were also many, many challenges and also violence that they could be exposed to if they tried to move into a neighborhood where there had previously been no black
people. Let's talk about some of these indignities. We're talking to Isabel Wilkerson, who is the author of The Warmth of Other Suns, The Epic Story of America's Great Migration, because as you point out at some point, I think in an interview that I read with you, that you don't talk about colored water fountains and blacks-only bathrooms in this as being the indignities. You go into greater, much greater indignities that many people today would be, even African-Americans today, would be surprised to hear about.
You're absolutely right. I actually make very little reference to the restrooms and water fountains because we know about that already. I spent a great deal of time just trying to understand what it was like to wake up in the morning with this system in place and to live throughout an entire day with it, and then have to end your day with it as well. And this was a caste system that created walls and barriers between everyone. This caste system affected everyone, black and white, perhaps not in a way that people even think about it. In other words, the whole idea of a black person and a white person not being able to play checkers in Birmingham means that there were black people who couldn't play with their white friends, and white people could not have played with their black friends. That's how complete and total this separation had to be. And it put pressure on everyone to stay within the borders of their own world, which meant that people who might have been wonderful friends or might have been might have had amazing and wonderful interactions with people, so those interactions simply didn't happen to such a degree that an anthropologist of the day said that it was unlikely that people in the South had ever shaken the hand of a person of another race, because that was one of the protocols that could not be broken.
And that's an example, I think, of the perversity of all this. Because on the one hand, you have those situations and you have this caste system in place that's almost impossible for an African-American to escape. And yet, when they tried to leave, they made it very difficult and in some cases impossible for these people to leave. They would clear out the train stations or force the train not to stop at a station where a lot of African-Americans have gathered because they didn't want them to leave.
Yes. Well, one of the reasons that the caste system had been created was for economic reasons. And the reason was that in much of the South at that time, remember, we have to hurl ourselves back before the days in which many cities of the South and states of the South were major industrial centers as we know them now. But this was a primarily agricultural and largely rural part of the country. And the economy required not just a supply of cheap labor, but an oversupply of cheap labor in order to work the land and to maintain, plant, and ultimately harvest the rice, the sugar cane, the cotton, and the tobacco that were the lifeblood of the South for much of the history of our country. And for that reason, they needed to make sure that that cheap labor was in place and at the ready for the hard work that had to be done to maintain the system. And in order to make them feel as if they could not, they had no options, there had to be a caste system to maintain the limits and restrictions on them. When the individuals had, when these people in large numbers had the opportunity to leave, and that came during World War One, when it was the North that had a problem. The North had a problem because immigration had shut down from Europe, and the European immigrants who were working the railroads and the boundaries and the steel mills of the North were no longer available to do the work. The North began to recruit African Americans to go north to work in those fields and those factories and steel mills. And so when that happened, that meant that the South had a problem in that it was about to lose a good portion of its cheap labor, and it did whatever it could to keep the people from leaving. People were arrested on the railroad platforms. They were arrested from their train seats. And when there were too many people to arrest, they would wave the trains on through so that people have been waiting for or saving for months what little they had to get to what they perceived as freedom, had to watch that train leave without them. So there was a great effort to keep the people from leaving, because this was really about economic survival, mm-hmm. both North and South.
And I've forgotten which one of these stories that you focus on in this book talks about pretty much sneaking out of town, loading up the car as surreptitiously as they could, telling the children to be quiet, and then leaving town, even though it was a small town and most of the people knew that they were up to something, to get out before they were discovered.
Yes, that was a case, and there were several cases. One of them was in Mississippi, another one was in Louisiana, in which there was a great deal of fear, anxiety, nervousness, and the children who recall it remember being afraid themselves, seeing their parents so nervous and anxious about getting out, and that the children had to be quiet, that the children had to do things that children are not natural to children, keep their heads down, not be visible. They were leaving in the middle of the night. They were sleepy. There was a great deal of danger associated with leaving a place where clearly there had been an effort to keep them from leaving.
Reminiscent to a certain degree to the Underground Railroad.
It is. I actually call it the Overground Railroad.
Isabel Wilkerson is our guest, the winner of the Pulitzer Prize and the author of The Warmth of Other Suns, the epic story of America's Great Migration, in which millions of African Americans left the South for other parts of the country in the early parts of the 20th century, right up to the mid-70s, actually. We have to take a break. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, and our guest today is Isabel Wilkerson, the author of The Warmth of Other Suns, the epic story of America's Great Migration. You kind of jumped the gun on me and answered my question about why conditions seem to have been ripe from the end of World War II to the beginnings of the middle of the 1970s for people to do it. But conditions in that period of time, what is it, 60 years, 55 years, somewhere in there? I can't do the math.
55 years.
Conditions changed over that time. So why did it continue? If conditions were ripe in the beginning because they needed inexpensive labor in the North and people thought they could go and get paid for things that they had been working for almost nothing for, and that they thought that maybe Jim Crow would slip away and their lives would be better, and they discovered that maybe they weren't going to be that much better, and yet the migration continued. Why?
Well, that's because we're thinking about the push and the pull. The pull would have been the idea that there was a better opportunity in the places that were drawing them. The push had not changed throughout the time of this migration.
Even into the mid-70s?
The migration ended in the mid-70s.
Right.
It was over. It was by that time it was over, and it was over because the push came to an end. In other words, the reasons, the ultimate reasons why people were leaving, the caste system, as we had described, the world in which there was such division that most people who were in the South had not even so much as shaken the hands of a person of another race, that ended by the 1970s. And that ended because the civil rights legislation of the 1960s, 1964 and 1968, which made it possible for African Americans in the South or anywhere in the country to vote, to live wherever they might choose. All the civil rights legislation, which I must add, applied to all groups, not just African Americans, but in the civil rights legislation of 1968, provides fair housing for all groups of people, immigrants, regardless of nationality, of all kinds of barriers that had been up there before, so that the world changed dramatically as a result of the changes that occurred in the 1960s. And the South, however, there are parts of the South that resisted that legislation, and so that the actual implementation of what the civil rights legislation had required did not actually come into effect until the 1970s. And when it came into effect, the Great Migration ended. And then the shift began to occur, in which not only were people no longer leaving in the numbers that they were, but some people began to even return. And so it was a result of the fact that nothing had truly changed when it comes to the caste system as it had been created in the early 20th century. Nothing had changed, and that's the reason why so many people continued to leave during the Great Migration, and it didn't end until the 1970s.
Well, we are apparently in the middle of some sort of reverse migration, with thousands of people coming back to the place of their roots, of their ancestors, and leaving the cities that their ancestors moved to come back to the so-called New South. Is it on the scale, anything on the scale of the Great Migration about which you've written?
It is not on the scale when it comes to percentages in any way. The Great Migration was a watershed in history, in that it was the first time in American history that the people who had been lowest down in the caste system that we've described showed that they had options and were willing to take them. Regardless of however we might measure success, in absolute terms from our perspective in now the 21st century, this was the first chance that African Americans in large numbers had the chance to even have their children go to school for a full year, for example, in large numbers, or to be able to take music lessons and to become, say, a Thelonious Monk, who was from North Carolina. His parents migrated from North Carolina to New York, when he was 5 years old, where he had the opportunity to do something that he would not have been able to do in the tobacco fields of where his parents were from, and that was to take music lessons. And so they had opportunities to do things that they would never have been able to do. And that sea change in our country, it would be hard to replicate it, because the people are not leaving the same kind of hard and fast caste system that they were in some ways defecting, kind of voting against, you might say. And they did what immigrants do, and that was done. That was done, and now it has changed the North and the South. What's happening now is what I consider a return migration. I don't like the use of the term reverse, because reverse, when you put your car in reverse, it sounds like you're going backward. And I don't think that anyone in the places that they're going to would want to view a return to North Carolina or to Georgia as a mistake or going backward. I view any migration as a move toward someplace better, something better for the families that are making that decision. And in this particular migration, I view it as in some ways one of the legacies of the original migration, because the grandparents and parents of people who are making the return migration now to the South, because their grandparents did what they did by leaving the only place that they'd ever known for a place that they'd never seen, jumping off a cliff. Many of these people had never been outside of the county into which they were born, in Mississippi or Georgia or wherever it might have been. And they went to the biggest, most forbidding cities in our country, New York and Pittsburgh and Chicago and Los Angeles. They went to all these places, but they'd never been there before. They experienced cold, and they experienced snow, and they experienced ghettos, and they experienced overcrowding, and all of these things that they'd never been exposed to before, and they did it so that perhaps their children would have a better opportunity. And their children grew up, and their children have the opportunity to live anywhere in this country that they choose as a result of the decisions that their parents made. And they can return to the region of their own grandparents' birth, because things have changed so much that they can live anywhere they want. And that's one of the great legacies of this Great Migration.
Yeah, I want to talk about the impact that this Great Migration had on the cities and the nation as a whole. But I also want to talk about the impact that the Great Migration had on the individuals who made the trip, because surely this changed them in profound ways. And you say that of the three people that you focus on in this book, Ida May is the one that seems to have had the most success in adapting to this new world that she found herself in and maintaining the inner core of who she is. Talk about that.
That is just such a great question. I'm so glad you mentioned that. You know, each of the three people in this book had some measure of success by whatever definition you might choose. And you look for a measure of success in any migration for someone to pick up and to leave everything that they know for something that they have no guarantees of being able to make it. That's just a tremendous sense of fortitude and courage that I think makes me feel such a sense of awe for anyone who would do it, whether they are leaving Ireland for the United States or China for California, whatever their choice of migration is. And the same with these people. When it comes to Dr. Foster, he had tremendous financial success, but he in some ways turned his back on all that he had known in the South. He adopted everything that he could of the new place, but he kind of lost touch with the old and kind of lost touch in some ways with his core values in some ways and all that had in some ways given him the foundation of who he had become.
He ended up being a physician, if I'm not mistaken, to Ray Charles, correct?
He certainly did. He became fabulously successful as a physician in California, beyond perhaps even his own dreams.
And Ray Charles ended up writing a song about him.
Yes, he wrote a song called Hide Nor Hair, which became a hit in the early 1960s, and it actually makes direct reference to him about Dr. Foster having medicine and money, and thus basically in the fable of the song, taking his girlfriend away. That's
yes.
The story.
So he lost his way somewhat.
Yes. So his story was one of having great financial and career success, but at a cost, you might say. And the second person, George Starling, he's someone who found the freedom from the Jim Crow violence, which he almost became a victim of. He came close to losing his life as a result of trying to stand up for himself and the other workers that he was advocating for. And he found freedom, you might say, in New York to be the person that he wanted to be. But he too paid a price. It was Ida Mae Gladney who left Mississippi in really the most dire of circumstances, having been the wife of a sharecropper, very, very poor, arriving in the big city of Chicago, very, very poor, having an extremely difficult time of making go of it, had a really hard time finding work. Her husband had trouble finding work. She had trouble finding work. They had arrived during the Depression, during the 1930s, which is a difficult time for anyone. And yet, they've made a way for themselves. They managed to buy a home in a neighborhood that changed right around them. They were among the first blacks to move into this neighborhood. The neighborhood changed from white to black almost overnight. And as a result of that, became a very troubled neighborhood because it had lost the foundation overnight. All of the stores left. Everything just defected from that neighborhood she was in. And yet she found a way to find joy in her life and to find a sense of spiritual peace that was in some ways a credit to the fact that she had maintained the values that had been the good things about being Southern. She maintained her Southern accent from the moment that she had left until well into her 90s, until her 80s. She retained the food. She made she made sweet potato pie as well as anyone in the Delta, but she also made sure that she was on top of whatever the Chicago Bulls were doing, the basketball team there. She was someone who maintained the best of the South, along with adopting the best of the places she had adopted. And she was, for that reason, the happiest of them all, mm-hmm. because she had found a way to find personal contentment in her circumstances, difficult though they may have been.
Right. We only have about 5 minutes left, but that's one of the things I did want to talk about, the fact that when people move, I don't care who you are, where you're from, or where you end up going, when you go, at least the first generation maintains a lot of the things that they grew up with. They maintain their culture. They maintain their accent, in this case, sometimes their language. They maintain the food. They maintain the cultural habits. And when masses of people maintaining those things come into a new area, That has to rub off. That did change the North and the Midwest, didn't it?
Absolutely. You're absolutely right. In fact, one of the greatest legacies of this migration was that it was in some ways a huge transfer of Southern culture to the North in a way that never would have occurred had the people not left, because much of the folklore and music had been retained, you might say, isolated in the places that they were from. They carried with them the blues and the spirituals and the gospel music, and once they arrived, their children transformed that into whole different kinds of music, but with still the Southern tradition and basis for it, so that music as we know it, not just in the United States, but for the world, because the United States has exported so much music to the rest of the world, has been fundamentally changed because so many Southerners, so many African Americans in particular, carried their culture with them when they went to the North. Such things as Motown simply would not have existed had there been no great migration.
Barry Gordy would not have existed. Diana Ross would not have existed. Yeah.
Absolutely. As we know it, would not have existed,
right,
because so many of the leaders of it had been children of the Great Migration. I'm thinking of Miles Davis, whose parents migrated from Arkansas to Illinois. I'm thinking clearly of Thelonious Monk, whose parents migrated from North Carolina to New York, and of course of John Coltrane, whose parents migrated from North Carolina, who he himself migrated from North Carolina to Philadelphia at the age of 16. And it was in Philadelphia that he got his first alto sax.
Before this conversation, we asked some of our listeners to email some questions if they had any. And Sharon in Charlotte writes, I really enjoyed reading this book. And while reading, I came across my great-grandmother's name, Amanda Poindexter, on page 239. I asked someone with an Ancestry.com membership to look into it for me, and she confirmed it is her. Isabel Wilkerson's mother knew my great-grandmother in Rome, Georgia.
That is amazing. I am speechless.
Well, maybe you'll meet her when you're in town. Everett on Facebook wants to know, who named it the Great Migration, and why don't we call it ethnic cleansing?
Wow. The Great Migration is a term that was coined during World War I when it began, and the irony of that is that it was viewed as having been over in World War I, and it had only just begun.
Mm. And your book is called The Warmth of Many Suns for what reason?
It's called The Warmth of Other Suns because of a beautiful passage that I happened to come across in the course of working on this book, and it was a passage from Richard Wright, and I read it everywhere. It's very short, if you would like me to.
Sure, go ahead.
It reads, I was leaving the South to fling myself into the unknown. I was taking a part of the South to transplant in alien soil, to see if it could grow differently, if it could drink of new and cool rains, bend in strange winds, respond to the warmth of other suns, and perhaps to bloom.
Took a long time for the flower to bloom, but I think it obviously did. And that's the triumph and the tragedy of all this, I suppose, is that the people who had the courage to make those initial trips would never necessarily see the fruits of that endeavor, and it would have to pan out much later on. Very quickly, because I have 30 seconds, what did all this cost the South?
You know, I get asked that all the time, and I think it is an unknowable question. Part of it is economic, of course, but I think the most important thing is spiritual. To lose, to have this many people, millions of people, give up on their own homeland is a message to everyone that there is this deep spiritual cancer, one might say, that was rampant in the land and needed to be addressed.
Isabel Wilkerson, The Warmth of Many Others, The Warmth of Other Suns, the epic story of America's Great Migration. Thank you for the hour. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.